Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the panel on Indian environmental law. I'm glad to see you all here this morning. And how many of you were able to sit in on the panel just before this in this room on the extractive industries in Indian country? There was some depressing information presented there and a lot of problems to deal with. I hope this session will give us a little bit of a flip side of that. There has been a lot of progress. Of course, through history, tribes have maintained and protected their resources because they relied upon them for survival. But after, once the reservation era began, once removals began, tribes lost most of the tools that they had used to protect their resources. And I'm talking about things like controlled fires to improve grasses for buffalo, deer, and other game species. In the Pacific Northwest, where the upstream and downstream tribes had agreements so that everybody had enough salmon to eat without overfishing the salmon and thereby protecting that resource for generations to come. They lost a lot of those tools, but after, and our panelists will talk about this much more because they're the experts in this, after the Indian Reorganization Act, and especially after self-determination in the 1970s, tribes began to gather more power to not only protect their own lands, but what's been happening in recent years, they've been using Indian law combined with environmental law to extend protections to broader stretches of the countryside that go beyond Indian country. So I'd like to introduce our panelists this morning. First is Professor Taiwagi Helton. He is a professor at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. He joined in 2001. He teaches environmental law, property law, and Indian law. His research emphasizes environmental and natural resources issues relating to Native Americans, as well as nation building in Indian country. He began his career as a legal clerk for the Honorable Robert H. Henry, U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. He served as a special justice for the Cheyenne and Arapaho Tribes Supreme Court and as a member of the Board of Directors of Oklahoma Indian Legal Services. In 2012, Professor Helton received the OU Regents Award for Superior Teaching. He earned his Master's of Law degree from Yale Law School in 2001. In 1999, he received a Juris Doctor degree with highest honors from the University of Tulsa College of Law, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Tulsa Law Journal and earned membership in the Order of the, Curule Chair. So please welcome Professor Helton. And we're also delighted to have with us Jason Amott, who is the Assistant Dean for Online Legal Education at the University of Tulsa College of Law, where he teaches international environmental law and water law while administering the online programs. Professor Amott is published in numerous journals and in 2005 will publish two book chapters focused on sustainable development and water law.
2015 this year. You said five.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Pardon me. 2015. I'm 10 years behind here. Mr. Amott obtained certification of the first geographically defined toxic tort class in Oklahoma. The National Law Journal ranked one of his jury verdicts as one of the top 100 verdicts in the United States in 2013. He has a JD from the University of Tulsa College of Law and a BS in chemistry from the state of New York. He's a founding member of the Indian and Environmental Law Center, which is a Midwestern law firm specializing in water rights, land damages, Indian law, toxic tort litigation. Among notable cases, the Tenth Circuit created a new cause of action while overruling the dismissal of one of Mr. Amott's trust accounting cases. So that's all of that is fascinating, and I'm not sure which parts of that will relate to our topic this morning, but I wanted to begin by asking both of you to give us an overview of how the developments in Indian law and environmental law have led to tribes being able to protect their own territories and broader areas.
Me first?
Sure.
Are you first? How about we do it kind of together? Okay. So Ty and I have known each other a long time. And
be sure and use the mic.
And I think this is the first time that we've ever appeared on a panel together.
Is that right? Not Socrates Symposium? You might be right.
I don't think so. I don't think we've ever done this before. It's kind of fun. I think you would agree with me that this question of tribal environmental jurisdiction is a bit checkered at the moment, and there are both opportunities and barriers that
no doubt
that we're going to talk about. Is that fair?
Yeah, for sure.
I know you want to talk about one of the really important barriers that the press really needs to be aware of, so I'm going to stay away from that.
Okay.
And leave that entirely for you. I want to talk about a couple of opportunities that have been kind of implemented in Oklahoma that I'm aware of. So just to give everyone kind of an idea about, we did coordinate a little bit here. So one of the places where there was an opportunity was in a case involving the Continental Carbon Company, or my favorite name for the company was actually the parent company, the China Synthetic Rubber Corporation. Why companies name themselves in such ways that makes them targets is something I've never quite understood. But in any event, Vicky actually did a really great documentary about that case involving Casey Camp and others and the Ponca tribe, which I think you can still get on the internet somewhere, maybe?
It is available on the internet, and I was proud to win an SEJ award for that piece. It's available on Living on Earth, or you can also find it through the NPR website.
So what happened was, this is one of the cases that Vicky mentioned. This is what happened in that case, is the Ponca tribe came to me and my dear friend Kaylin Free, who many of you I'm sure know, and said, hey, we have this terrible problem. There's this black dust that's falling on our homes, on the homes of the people who live in our reservation area. But the dust didn't discriminate. It fell on everyone's home, right? And so we looked at this situation, and we looked at the case, and we certified the very first geographic environmental class in Oklahoma. So what does that really mean? It means that the court said, okay, everyone within this boundary of this area where the people have been impacted now is going to be a part of this class action. And this class action is going to create a remedy that will stop the company from polluting all of these people and get all of these people damages for the pollution that's already occurred. And that's exactly what happened. So we're talking about the extraterritorial jurisdiction by Indian tribes. We're talking about Indian tribes saying, we can go outside of our boundaries using the environmental laws in order to provide a general benefit for the community.
And Jason, would you explain how the checkerboarding works within
sure.
these territories?
Well, Ponca is the best example of checkerboarding. The Ponca tribe, if you read the Bureau of Ethnology's report for the Ponca tribe, you will see that in the very first paragraph, the Ponca tribe is singled out as the single most advanced political society in North America pre-human contact. That pre-European contact. Did I say human contact? Pre-European contact. They were equated as being equivalent to the Aztecs and the Mayas in Central America. That they're culture was very well developed, that they had this incredible system of politics, communication, and governance. If you go to White Eagle today, you can see really the tragic impact of colonialism. As Vicky knows, as Ty knows, the community there, the average income of a Ponca citizen today is less than, the family is less than $10,000 a year. I've been in many of the homes in that area, and there are many dirt floors. There are many dirt floors. Yes, I'm sorry. Let me speak up. So there's many dirt floors. You can see this terrible impact of colonialism, where it, once this great nation has now been kind of reduced to struggling. And so then the Poncas were removed from their traditional homelands around the confluence of the Niobrara and the Missouri Rivers. And when they were moved to Oklahoma, they were placed on, well, first they were placed, they were removed to Missouri. They pick
not quite that much detail because we're going to have to move through.
Yeah, they get out to Oklahoma and their tribe gets disestablished. They get out to the western area in Oklahoma and their tribe gets disestablished intentionally, and it's broken up and it's fractionated. And so you see the situation where in one place there's Indian lands, and then in another place right next door it's non-Indian lands. That's the checkerboarding that you're talking about. And so this class action applied to the entire checkerboard. Sorry, you asked me a question about the Poncas. I tend to go deep.
Understand. And we did a tour the other day, and I don't know if any of you were on that, but we came down that corridor, that Highway 177 that goes from Ponca City south, and Casey Camp Horanek, who was with us, pointed out all of the polluters along the way, and it is absolutely astonishing, not only continental carbon, but all of these other plants that have tremendous amounts of pollution. And that pollution is affecting not only the Ponca people, but everybody else who lives there, and that's where the importance of this lawsuit comes in.
Yeah, and I think that's really, for the purposes of today's talk, I think that's it, right? I think another place that we could talk about where there's not, another place that we could talk about where there's an opportunity for extraterritorial jurisdiction by Indian tribes also falls under the Clean Air Act. And in that case, air emissions from new sources, I'm sure you're all familiar with the concept of new sources under the Clean Air Act. They're required to get permits, and they go and they're subject to fairly rigorous review. One of the requirements for new source review is that Indian tribes within the affected airshed be provided with notification of the proposed permit. About 6 or 8 years ago, you may recall that TXU was seeking, Big Brown was looking to build 11 new coal-fired power plants along the Oklahoma and Texas border. And what they had failed to do is they'd failed to give notice to the Chickasaw and the Choctaw Nations. So we went down to the hearing before the State Office of Hearing and Appeals in Texas, completely extraterritorial to the Chickasaw and the Choctaw Nations, right? We're outside the boundaries of the nation. And we intervened in the matter, and we halted the proceedings in order to protect the Chickasaw and the Choctaw Nations' air quality over their boundaries. Ultimately, those coal plants weren't built. So then, finally, the last example that I would bring up is an opportunity, isn't air, but it's in water. In southeastern Oklahoma, as you're aware, the Chickasaw and the Choctaw Nations, again, have really taken a great interest in the water in that community. And by doing so, they've activated the community. So, as you know, water, again, doesn't respect boundaries. It doesn't respect who may be where, just like the air doesn't. But that provides opportunities for the communities to work together. And I know that many of your group went down to look at the mines, the mines that are going in the Arbuckle. Did anyone in this group go down to see to that on that tour? You did? Great. You would have met my friend Amy Ford down there. Maybe Dwayne Smith was in that group. Did you go to the TXU mine? No. Which you didn't get any of the mines. All right. Well, you're familiar then with what's happening is these sand and gravel mines, primarily gravel mines, are being dug deep down into the earth, 300, 400, 500 feet. And the aquifer is very shallow, so the top of the aquifer is only 25 feet. And when they dig the mine down, then the water flows in, and the water becomes a nuisance to mining. It's a little difficult to run heavy equipment underwater. So they then have to pump this water out.
It's Tar Creek all over again.
It is, yeah, it is. And so so the issue in this situation is what to do with the water. In fact, actually, the need to pump out the water in Tar Creek created an amendment to Oklahoma's water law back in the day, which prohibited the Water Resources Board from regulating the discharge of water from mines. So what did the Chickasaws and the Choctaws do? They banded together with the local community, and they changed that state law in order to have a positive impact on tribal resources, and to limit the way that the state law was going to impact the tribal resources. So that, I think, is another example of opportunities, or maybe crossing over a barrier to natural resources, natural resource management extraterritorially. So there's lots of other examples. There's fisheries in the Northwest. There's the new hunting license by the Cherokees here in Oklahoma, which I think is an extraordinary example of tribal extraterritorial management of natural resources. The kind of dimensions of which are yet to be fully understood. So with that, I would just say those are opportunities, and I'm going to let. So I've got the sunny side of life here. Ty's, however, going to give you more of the dimmer view, which I think has a sunny side as well.
It started as an opportunity for tribes to be able to regulate clean air and clean water, manage air and water on their lands. And Congress, Ty will tell us about this, granted the authority for tribes to apply for treatment as states for the purposes of environmental regulation. That didn't play out so well in Oklahoma.
So, you know, I mentioned this in the last panel that environmental justice issues affect the politically insignificant, right? They don't, you know, if they would affect people who mattered politically, then they wouldn't be done. So they tend to affect urban minorities, American Indians, and rural whites. They tend to be the ones to bear environmental consequences. Jurisdictional rules make those issues much more complicated. And Indian law is all about jurisdiction. If you took civics in high school, you were assuredly lied to about two important things. The first is you were probably told that we have a system of bilateral federalism, that is, two sovereigns make up this entire national government, and you were also told that we have a national government of limited enumerated powers, that is, the powers of the federal government are listed in the Constitution. But according to the Supreme Court, power over Indians has to exist somewhere, and it can't exist with the states because they've often been Indians' worst enemies. So it must exist in the federal government, and the branch where power over Indians exists is in Congress. And in 1886, when the court said this, they said that power over Indians is not found in the Constitution. The Commerce Clause doesn't justify it, the treaty power, the war power, none of those things do, but Congress still has plenary authority over Indian affairs. What that means is that you may enter these kind of questions without realizing that we have what now amounts to a system of trilateral federalism. We have three sovereigns, tribal sovereigns, the national government, and the state governments, and they wind up often fighting with each other about who has jurisdiction, because just as we as individuals protect our bodily autonomy, sovereigns protect their sovereign authority in a similarly jealous way. And so very often there are conflicts because the state government or county government can't tolerate the idea that a tribe would be exerting jurisdiction over its own lands, let alone extraterritorially. But there really are some opportunities. You know, I think another example with the Chickasaws and Choctaws is that when we've talked about how to use water in Oklahoma in the next 50 years, there are really loud voices coming out of Oklahoma City and Tulsa, right? Urban water users have inordinate influence in state legislatures, and a lot of non-native people in southeastern Oklahoma felt like they weren't being heard, that their water resources or the water in their backyard was going to be pumped to places like Oklahoma City out of their watershed. And it turned out that it was only the tribes having a legal right to exert that really gave voice to the non-natives who wanted to keep water where they were too. And so I think that's one good example. Another good example in water is that there's the Isleta Pueblo in Arizona or in New Mexico had treatment as state authority under the Clean Water Act. So they could designate the appropriate use of a stream. Well, the city of Albuquerque dumped so much of its wastewater into the Rio Grande that if it was a river, Albuquerque would have been the fifth largest tributary to that river. They issued water that had contaminants in it, and the tribe redesignated the water as only being useful for ceremonial uses, which meant Albuquerque, in order to get a permit from the EPA to continue discharging into the river, had to clean its water up so much that the water could be used to grow ceremonial crops and for ceremonies. That had this upstream effect. It was not the exercise of tribal jurisdiction. It was the tribe set a standard for its on-reservation resources, and the Clean Water Act has a rule that says you can't get a permit to discharge from the EPA unless you can prove that you won't harm downstream sovereigns' water quality standards. So by setting higher water quality standards for themselves, it had the consequence of cleaning up water for everybody north of them. You often hear that story told as the tribe used this extremely high environmental standard to make Albuquerque have to spend a lot of money, but I think a better spin on it is that the tribe exerted authority delegated from Congress under the Clean Water Act, and it had the consequence of returning the water to the river to a pristine state that it hadn't seen in a really long time. So there are real opportunities, even where there are sovereign conflicts. But there are also some troubling areas, too. Again, states very often fight the exercise of any tribal jurisdiction whatsoever because they seem very jealous of being the only sovereign in the room. But there's sort of two timelines to keep in mind. One is the Indian law timeline, where we've seen federal Indian policy change depending on the answer to the Indian problem about whether tribes should be forced to assimilate. It was the General Allotment Act of 1887 that caused individual parcels of land to be taken out of tribal communal ownership and given to individual Indian families, and then the rest was deemed surplus and open to non-Indian settlement. That's what really triggers checkerboard land ownership. It's the series of statutes that implement the General Allotment Act, which Teddy Roosevelt describes as a mighty pulverizing engine to break up the tribal mass, and about two-thirds of tribal lands were lost, scattered amongst now non-tribal lands. And so that's why jurisdiction is so complicated, because who owns the land may determine what sovereign can regulate. So as you drive down the road, you may find that you're subject to tribal jurisdiction. So the EPA makes some effort to have uniform authority, and one way they've done that is with TAS authority. But I thought it might be valuable to sort of jump back in time to talk about the history of environmental law and how we get to what's known as cooperative federalism or environmental federalism. But I've already talked a long time, so maybe I should save the rest.
I think that's really important.
Okay, great. Please. So, environmental protection was historically a subject of local government. So you go back to the 1630s, the city of London starts to address smog and air pollution because there's so much coal being burned there. And you may remember that a species of butterfly goes from being, you know, white or white and black spotted to only black because natural selection was affected by this shift in the environment of all the trees being covered black. So they first start to regulate the environment for air quality. But for the most part, first state government regulates through zoning and land use requirements, and then beyond that, states start to regulate land quality and environmental protection. The feds don't really get involved to any meaningful extent until 1970 or so, or 1969, right around the time of the Environmental Revolution. There are a couple of exceptions. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act in 1948 was largely toothless, and the Rivers and Harbors Act in 1896 or so. But for the most part, states dealt with it, and not very well. It wasn't until 1962 when Rachel Carson shocks the American conscience with her groundbreaking book, Silent Spring, that we start to see not just the dangers of the pesticide DDT, but the fact that there are all kinds of unintended consequences to our behavior, right? You spray a cockroach, your intention is to kill the cockroach, but the unintended consequences include that stuff washing off, it turning into powder, and your pet breathing it in. There are all kinds of consequences for our uses that aren't intended. And environmental law is very much addressing those kind of consequences. So we wind up with this awakened American conscience out of books like Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac and Silent Spring. But we also have the Cuyahoga River catching on fire in 1969.
I'm sorry, Ty. We maybe not.
Okay, let's fast forward then.
Quite that much history.
So there are all these environmental issues explode, and finally we realize we've got to do something about it. So we get an emergency response. But Congress can't just step in and take over control because it's an area, as a matter of federalism, of traditional state government. And so if Congress steps in, they're going to be taking away state authority. So we ended up with two problems. One, terrible environmental problems. Two-thirds of the rivers and streams were not fishable and swimmable at the time the Clean Water Act was passed. Lakes were turning into lifeless sumps. There was a race to the bottom, that Mississippi was advertising that it had lower environmental regulations in order to attract business. And so the Rust Belt states where cars were being built got annoyed by this. And it's the same thing you heard with NAFTA, with Mexico having lower employment standards and environmental standards. There was this race to the bottom where states were lowering their standards or felt pressure to. And we have this problem of transboundary pollution. As Jason said, water and air ignore the arbitrary chalk lines that we strike on a map. And so where the pollution is emitted may not be where the pollution does its harm. And so we wound up effectively federalizing a good bit of environmental law. So starting in 1969 with the National Environmental Policy Act, and then 34 statutes in 3 years.
I'm sorry, Ty, we have about 15 minutes before we go to questions.
Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. Okay.
So
we pass all these statutes, the federal government takes over a good role, but they still leave something to the states. This thing called environmental federalism or cooperative federalism, where the national government sets national uniform standards, but those standards are implemented by the states. So tribes can be treated as a state if they get specific permission from the EPA. And what that means is they have authority under the Clean Water Act to implement the federal standards, under the Clean Air Act to implement the federal programs, just like a state would. So we have uniform standards that are implemented on a state-by-state basis or tribal-by-tribal basis. Sorry.
And what I really wanted to get to is the Midnight Rider that prohibits the Oklahoma tribes from being treated as states.
Which that is the perfect background for.
Oh, thanks. So, right, we've got these economic and political pressures making states want to lower environmental standards. So the Pawnee apply for treatment as a state, and they get it under the Clean Water Act. So the EPA says you can set water quality standards and you can grant permits. That causes a backlash, and so Oklahoma politicians ask Senator Inhofe to do something, and literally at the 11th hour, he inserts a rider in 2005 in a highway appropriations bill that says no tribe can get EPA permission to be treated as a state without the permission of the state of Oklahoma first. Oklahoma is the only place in the country where this is true. As you might guess, the state of Oklahoma has never given permission for a tribe to get treatment as a state since then. And we are now on the 10th anniversary of, again, it's described as the Midnight Rider. Even John McCain railed against it when it happened because nobody knew it was in this appropriations bill when it happened. But it has had this consequence of, just as tribes in Oklahoma were starting to find this place within our system of cooperative federalism, this late night rider that virtually no one read was implemented, and now tribes are stuck only exerting jurisdiction under the incredibly complicated jurisdictional rules of Indian law.
And are there examples of tribes that have in other states that have effectively used their authority under TAS?
Oh, no doubt. There are about 30 tribes, I think, with Clean Air Act TAS authority. I think one of the best examples is the Northern Cheyenne tribe. And this shows an intertribal conflict as well. They share a border with the Crow Reservation. The Crows wanted to do coal mining. The Northern Cheyenne thought that that was an affront to nature. And the dust that would blow downwind from the coal mines would have affected the air quality on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. So they used their authority to stop that mining from taking place. Another really good example, I think, is with the Isla de Pueblo and the city of Albuquerque protecting water resources for more than just the tribe.
Thank you. And Jason, I'd like to go back to Continental Carbon, the Carbon Black case. Recently, in June, there was finally a settlement. So would you tell us a little bit about that, about what's happened as a result of all of the litigation, and without going into a whole lot of detail?
Sure. I won't start with the prehistory of the Poncas again, I promise. The Carbon Black litigation that we talked about concluded in 2009, and as a consequence of that litigation, there was an agreement whereby the company agreed to limit the quantity of pollution that it was putting out. It also agreed to create a system of compensation for the entire community, so that if anyone claimed to have been impacted by the pollution, then they could make a claim to the company, and it would be paid, and their home would be cleaned up. More recently, and during kind of the throes of the end of that litigation, the EPA got involved. And the EPA has an authority very similar to your FOIA authority, only a little bit more so, since it's a governmental entity. It's called Section 114 of the Clean Air Act. Under Section 114 of the Clean Air Act, the EPA or a state can send an information request to any permitted source or any source of an unpermitted facility as well. And in the Section 114 request is the boon to all lawyers, by the way. It requires an enormous amount of legal work to answer. And it results in a huge quantity of data and information being supplied. Well, my understanding is the Section 114 request that EPA sent to the Continental Carbon Company led the EPA generally to look at this question of carbon black around the country. And one of the places where that has arrived at a result is with the Continental Carbon Company having to make an agreement this year that it would install new equipment at its plants. Can I digress for 1 second?
Certainly.
Can I take two minutes? Because Ty touched on something that was really interesting that I think we can connect here. We think about regulating the environment in terms of the quality of the environment, right? We say we don't want so much quantity of pollutants in the atmosphere, or we want our rivers and streams to be this clean. And Ty mentioned that the Clean Water Act of 1948, forget exactly what the title was, but it was the Clean Water Act from 1948, the old Clean Water Act, did exactly that. It said, these are the ambient standards for pollution that will have to exist in the streams. It was an abject failure. Didn't work at all. Then when the Clean Water Act was renewed in 1972 and a fresh look was taken at this problem because of all the issues that Ty pointed out, then what Congress did is it said, we're going to regulate the technology that is implemented in terms of how this stuff gets out. And I think this is important to your work, right? Because it's this inferential method of looking at not the impact that it necessarily has on the environment, but instead how the companies are operating. A lot of times you probably get questions from the companies. I know I do as a lawyer. Why are you so concerned about how we do things, right? It's our job to do our job inside the fence. Why do you really care about what's happening inside the fence? Well, the reason you care about what's happening inside the fence is because that's what's actually being regulated. The air itself, the concentration and the quantities in the air itself aren't the thing that's actually being regulated. The thing that's being regulated is how that stuff gets there. And so I think that's what this settlement does ultimately with the EPA in 2015 is it requires the Continental Carbon Company to put in new equipment so that its emissions are lower. So thanks for the chance to digress, and I thought that would be a nice way to connect what we were talking
Thank
about.
Thank you. And I do want to share a little more background on what was happening with Continental Carbon. They there was technology long ago that would have allowed that plant to be much less dirty than it was. But as they were operating near White Eagle, near Ponca City, houses miles downwind would be covered with thick, fine particulates. You'd walk across grass, it would cover your legs up to your knees. White-faced sheep that were prized for their pure white wool would turn black from this carbon. For years and years and years, and hundreds of complaints, the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality never found that continental carbon had violated any clean air rules. They continually ruled that what they found when they took samples the next day after they'd get a complaint was that it wasn't carbon black that they were finding on these sheep or the windowsills or in the grass. When I did the story, I finally got DEQ to admit that the test that they used to determine whether or not it was in fact carbon black in those samples was not capable of making that determination. The other rule that DEQ had was that their own inspectors had to witness the carbon coming across the fence line and leaving the factory boundaries.
Or it wasn't a violation.
Or it wasn't a violation. And, of course, continental carbon usually release their emissions at night when the sky is dark and the inspectors weren't there. So for many, many years, there was nothing done about this. People who had allotments in that area, had original descendants of original allottees, as early as the 1950s were waking up blowing black stuff out of their nose because the pollution was so bad. Their white chickens turned black. They were demanding to get other land to be moved away from that plant, and it never happened. And finally, they got moved. But the BIA had said, and there were memos to this effect, we cannot sell that land because it's too contaminated to sell.
I want to be very specific on this because it is a particularly black mark. 1972, it was a memo between the assistant regional, it was a 1972 memo between the assistant regional director and the regional director for the Bureau. And it looks at the 30 acres that are immediately contiguous to the carbon black plant, and it says, what can we do with this property? And it says there's really nothing we can do with this property because it's so polluted, except we could use it for Indian housing.
Exactly. So, yeah, what happened was they built low-income Indian housing directly under the stacks of this plant. 20 families were living there with little children. The children couldn't be allowed outside to play. Many of them had asthma. And it took lawsuits to get them out of that horrible situation.
But there's a horrible situation, right? There's a terrible barrier. And the good news from the terrible barrier is that when a tribe goes out and it implements its authority, its legal authority, through the court system, using the tools that are available under the Clean Air Act, using the tools that are available under tort law, that it can ameliorate that problem, fix it. And it can fix it not just for its own members and not just for the other Indian folks living in the area, but it fixes it for the whole area. And here was a situation where the state refused to act. In fact, actually, in that case, the state intervened and objected to another lawsuit that was seeking to implement provisions of the Clean Air Act against the same plant, and said, no, there's no reason. Has anyone gone down to ODEQ and ever tried to interview anyone down at ODEQ? Yes, no. Well, you should, just for this experience. When you go down there now, you have to get a badge and you have to sign in. And the reason that you have to get a badge and sign in is because it was the union that had filed that previous Clean Air Act lawsuit. And when the DEQ objected to the union's lawsuit, all of the union members went down and conducted a sit-in in DEQ. They actually sat down and they occupied the entire building. There was no entrance sign-in requirement at that point. as a result of their sit-in, now the DEQ requires that you get a badge and that you become registered before, and that you sign that says that you'll leave when they ask you to.
And we have just a few minutes before we're going to open it up to questions. And I'd like to move to sort of the flip side of this. In many cases, communities around tribal boundaries, around reservations, have a fear and distrust of what the tribe may do in exerting treaty rights, in exerting authority as under TAS or whatever, that may adversely affect them. So I'd like to ask Ty to discuss that a little bit.
Sure. This is a really good point. You know, if you're not a tribal citizen, you don't vote in the tribal election. And so if that tribal government is able to have an effect on your environment or on you, and you can't vote in that tribal election, you feel like you're being regulated by an entity that you can't participate in. And Native people often feel that way about state governments. And I think it cuts both ways. You know, in this example, we know why the company was polluting, because it was cheaper to externalize the cost of pollution onto others than to clean it up. We know why the state government wasn't doing anything, because of the politics of financial interests. So because the tribe wasn't beholden to those financial interests, it was able to act. But that problem of not being beholden to predictable interests makes the exertion of tribal power unpredictable and therefore often scary to local non-natives. And I think there's this real sense, you know, in upstate New York, if tribes get rights to land, they're going to kick all the farmers off of their land, and a fear that if tribes can open a landfill, that they're not going to treat the landfill properly, and that they're going to end up allowing for groundwater contamination that affects local non-natives. And I think it's mostly an irrational fear. It's an unnecessary fear, but it's an understandable fear. But there's a very clear, I think, fear that among local community members, that if the tribe gets to exert jurisdiction, it'll exert jurisdiction in a really bad way or in a harmful way. And frankly, I think maybe that speaks to, you know, as a nation, we've treated other folks, you know, maybe in some bad ways, and we can only imagine that if they then had a jurisdiction or authority over us, maybe it would be, you know, bad in the other direction. You know, I think when you think about demographics changing in the U.S. and people being worried that minority populations are going to become a larger percentage, rather than working to, you know, a sort of pluralistic society where that doesn't matter so much, we're instead seeing people sort of hold out on possession of power for fear of how they'll be treated when they become a minority. And I think this is a sort of localized example of that.
Is that beginning to change as people see examples where tribes are regulating in a way that benefits the entire community?
I think it changes on a very localized basis. So you tend to see people despise minority populations most when they live next to them, right? I mean, in Ohio, it's easy for people to love Indians because after the Treaty of Greenville, almost all the Indians got moved out of Ohio. So now, you know, they're way easier to tolerate, having been gone for 150 years or so. So I think it's proximity that often creates the sort of racial tensions that we often see. But that's also where we see the problems get fixed, because it's when tribes become the largest employer and they turn out to, you know, spend more money on local infrastructure like fire trucks and roads and schools than the regular local government was doing, that people start to say, wow, you know, maybe tribal economic activity is not so bad, and maybe tribal government's not so bad. And when they see that they were about to lose all of their water, but the tribe stepped in and suddenly now not only does the tribe have water, but they do too, they start thinking, you know what, maybe we ought to be better with our neighbors and be better neighbors. And so I think, you know, it's very much on an ad hoc basis that where there's a good outcome in one place, you start to see shifting attitudes. But, you know, in North Dakota, there are, you know, very clear racial tensions that are going to be entrenched for a very, very long time. And no amount of economic activity, I think, is going to fix that anytime soon. So we're seeing bright spots, but I think they are isolated bright spots, and that you can't sort of have this broad theme of improvement.
So now I'd like to open it up to questions, and SEJ members have first priority. So,
I'm Christy George. I live in Oregon. I'm a freelancer. And I learned there that a lot of the Northwest tribes are not pulling the trigger on certain cases that they think that under treaties and so forth are just a slam dunk win, because they fear the Supreme Court ultimately overturning things that are, you know, just voting against them, despite the obvious reality. So I'm really interested in the Midnight Rider. Is that a case why is that not being contested? Is that a reason why it's not being contested for fear of losing even when you should?
First, Congress has authority to pass that statute, and they amended it. So there's not really a legal challenge to it, because Indians are a political group, not just a racial group. They're not subject to strict scrutiny for equal protection. And so, frankly, if Congress wants to take away TAS, tribes don't have a very strong legal argument that a U.S. court would recognize to stop them from doing so. So there, I don't think they're going to the courts for fear of the courts, but because they don't have that winning case. You know, for a long time, it was Congress, and it was the majoritarian branches acting on tribes and in the area of Indian affairs. And when you look at the worst Supreme Court cases in Indian law, they're always, it seems, cases where the court fails to act as the nation's conscience. It fails to rein in the majoritarian branches in its excesses. But in the 1970s, we shift into this era of self-determination where Congress says, you know what, conquest is over. We can have political enclaves within the U.S. without worrying about the U.S. falling apart. And we start to pass all these statutes promoting tribal self-governance and self-determination. And it seems that the court's uncomfortable with that. And starting in 1978 and 1981, but especially in the last couple of decades, where Congress is now supporting tribal sovereignty and funding tribal court systems and funding tribal police systems, the court has increasingly been mistrustful of it, and they have, in many ways, scholars have said, flipped Indian law on its head. And the Supreme Court now is viewed as rather anti-tribal. And so there are cases where it's clear the law is right on the tribe's side, but the tribe is afraid to adjudicate the case because the Supreme Court tends to grant certiorari and review cases where the tribe's won, and then deny cert where the tribes have lost. So it seems as though there's a certain level of activism on the Supreme Court for the purpose of constraining tribal jurisdiction. And that's true in environmental issues and land issues and criminal justice issues almost across the board. The Supreme Court has been remarkably hostile to tribal sovereignty over the last 30 years.
I would add to that and note there's an adage in the Indian law practice that the first rule of Indian law is the tribe will win unless the stakes are high.
We have another question and a reminder to say your name and your affiliation.
Hi, I'm Hillary Sloan and I'm freelance out of Southern California. So one thing I keep hearing is, I've been speaking to different groups on the Native American issues, is lack of awareness. People taking different positions and not understanding the whole. What kind of stories would you like to see about all of these issues, and what obstacles or openings are available? Please go
ahead. I think the stories that need to be told are the stories where, as Ty was mentioning and as I've mentioned, the community comes together to address a problem. And because those really are more commonly being the experience in Indian country and in our country generally today. You were talking about this concept of interior political enclaves and how that might impact the country. I think the press has a huge role to play to show that this is actually working, right? That Chickasaw Choctaw, where you talked about how perhaps on the statewide or the national basis there may be some issues with respect to tribal water rights, right? Let's look at it specifically for a second. You look at the statewide Farm Bureau in Oklahoma, and the statewide Farm Bureau has a policy on water rights, and the statewide Farm Bureau policy on water rights is anti-Indian water rights, okay? When you go down to Pontotoc County and you look at and you talk to the Pontotoc County Farm Bureau, and it's right there in the middle of Chickasaw Country, their policy is pro-Indian water rights. And so you see that those folks who are most directly experiencing the relationship with the Indian tribes are able to more fully understand what it means and how there are intended benefits, I think congressionally intended benefits, both for the communities and for the tribes, and that this concept of fear is getting in the way. So the educational process that you have as a reporter, as a person in the press, I think is very important, and I think that's the story that needs to be told, and it can be told across the country. This new Cherokee fishing and hunting licensure process, I mean, what a wonderful example of that. And all of the benefits that are going to come out of that. I think that's a great story to tell.
Yeah, I'd love to see more stories, as Jason says, where this works, that demonstrate that fear of tribal government is misplaced. That you know, so often the environmental agenda and the tribal agenda walks hand in hand. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, the crying Indian ad doesn't speak for everybody. There are times when tribes want to do economic development activities that environmentalists don't like. Frankly, when that happens, environmentalists can be the most paternalistic of any non-Indians and want to destroy any aspect of tribal sovereignty. Because that's hot, those are the stories that get told all the time. And we sort of ignore that it's newsworthy that hazardous waste sites got cleaned up through cooperation and that people that were afraid of tribal government suddenly wind up saying, thank goodness the tribe's there because they're the ones that saved our water. So I'd love to see more stories like that that show that fear of tribal governance is misplaced.
Other questions? Yes.
Hi, Mike Turbel Heights, University of Wisconsin. I just wanted to do a little bit of a clarification. I'm familiar with treatment as a state because the tribes in Wisconsin do have, a number of them do have that capability. When you talked about why they were able to organize this extraterritorial authority with the Carbon Black case and also down in the aquifer, I'm not clear what the authority was there for the tribes to be able to serve.
So with the water, the tribes had a right to ownership of some of that water. So when they asserted their right to a certain quantity and quality of water, that stopped the proceedings and then had the effect of helping local non-natives from losing their water too. So it was a right that the Supreme Court recognized in two cases in the early 1900s, Winans versus the United States, and more importantly, United States or Winters versus United States. Under the Winters Doctrine. So it
based
was
on
right
treaty rights. This is based on treaty rights.
Yes, based on treaty rights.
In terms of the issues in Carbon Black, right? That's using just good old fashioned federal civil procedure.
So that wasn't really because you were kind of talking about the extraterritorial things at the same mm-hmm. time, and so that was where.
But it's just as powerful a way of going about it to use kind of the more generalized statutes in order for a tribe to exert its authority extraterritorially is no less than using a specific statute to do so. What was your other? Those were the two. I guess those were the two questions. Yeah, that's it.
So one more thing about the Carbon Black too. So the tribe had, legitimate interest in protecting the interests, its own land and the land interests of its citizens. That it was an entity that could act collectively in a way that scattered citizens couldn't without getting class action. And so there's sort of a lot of negotiation and upfront costs to pulling people together. And the tribe as an entity was already able to act collectively. And so I think they were able to sort of drive that litigation in a way that wouldn't have happened because no individual had a deep enough pocket to pursue things at the start before the class action was certified.
And the state was antagonistic.
One thing we might both make a pitch for our programs. In addition to teaching law students, we also have a master's in legal studies in Indian law that's an online program. And if you write about the environment, you have to know something about the law in order to write coherently. And if you want to know something about Indians, you have to know something about Indian law and policy in order to write coherently. And so we've created an online program that's 2 years part-time or 1 year if you go full-time, so that you can learn about the U.S. legal system and about the history of federal Indian law and policy, including some specific classes like Native American Natural Resources, for people who don't want to practice law but touch up against it in their day-to-day lives, whether they're a tribal official, an environmental reporter, or someone else. And so if you're interested in that sort of thing, you can do it online wherever you are in the country, and you'll get a chance to really take this broad survey of all of the issues that arise in this context. And our program's graduated a couple of classes now, and we've had altogether remarkable feedback from our students on that point.
Yeah, OU has a wonderful program that does that. The University of Tulsa has a similar online program in Indian law. And in addition, we have an online program in energy, environment, and natural resources law as well. So, which yours is in person. And they're roughly, what's kind of fun about it is they're roughly equivalent. It's kind of fun that we have the same thing kind of going. I think there are other opportunities for similar online education at Arizona State. Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of any other Indian. Yeah. So if you're interested in those things, you should look at those three schools and see which best fits your needs.
Yeah, one of the nice things about being in Oklahoma is that the three law schools are good neighbors, and we get along really well. And so it's sort of a win for everybody that we don't have a tendency toward antagonism. And I think that's the lesson we want people to learn, is that tribes are in it for the long haul, and they're good neighbors. You know, they're the local population experiencing environmental consequences.
So you tend to get better environmental outcomes from people that are among those bearing the burdens.
Do we have more
Thank
questions?
You,
yeah.
Me too.
My name's Liz Devitt. I'm a freelance writer in Northern California, and I'm just starting to cover the land use issues with various Northern California tribes. And one of the things that interests me is a little bit different, but the conservation, some of the Northern California tribes are starting to work with the land trusts and assert more stewardship over the lands by working with them and increase water quality, you know, the rivers that are trying to be manipulated by the state. So as I'm hearing these stories, my question is, nationally, there's so many different, you know, different state laws, so many different tribal interests, but the underlying issue is better stewardship and reclaiming the stewardship that I hear tribal leaders say is their mandate. So is there a national resource, where tribes are communicating with each other as to how they, you know, get this resource back, or steward that? And is there, where would you encourage reporters to go in their state, like in California, so they would look there for resources for state law, regarding all the different tribes?
I guess my disbe, you go ahead.
The network that you're describing, I think, is a rather loose network of personal relationships. I can't think of a national native environmental organization that shares this kind of stuff. Maybe we ought to have one. Maybe in the National Congress of American Indians has a subgroup, but I don't think they have one on the environment specifically. Maybe the they do? Okay, great. So you might check NCAI. But then locally, you might check to see whether you've got a law school that has a professor that teaches in the areas, either environmental law or in the area of Indian law. And we tend to be approachable. I mean, if you want, you're welcome to call me if you've got questions. I assume Jason's available, though he works for a living. I would say start with the law schools in your state, and law professors tend to be pretty accessible.
I would also add Native American Rights Fund. There's a lawyer there named Melody McCoy at Native American Rights Fund. And then one of the folks who used to be attached to Native American Rights Fund, who's done a lot of work in this area, who's now in Oklahoma, is Walter Echohawk. And I could see Walter as a resource on those issues as well. Happy to give you his number afterwards if you'd like. The question you brought up, though, was land trust, and I wanted to just emphasize something. The Cherokees just signed a huge deal with the Nature Conservancy and a local landowner in eastern Oklahoma. It's a new 15,000-acre nature preserve that's been established in large part for the purposes of protecting the Illinois River. So what you say is exactly true.
We have another question here. Please say who you are and who.
I work at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Oregon. And in my region, there's a lot of tribes that are trying to fight fossil fuel exports. And there's a number of different arguments that they're making, but one of the arguments that I've been hearing is about climate change. And so they're actually trying to make this argument that burning fossil fuels will interfere with their treaty fishing rights. And I wonder if you've seen other cases where tribes are taking on the issue of climate change, and I'm wondering what kind of legal avenues might exist for the tribes to tackle that issue.
Yeah, you go with Kivalina and I've got an Anna.
Okay, great.
The best example I can think of is the native village of Kivalina in Alaska. They are being relocated by the federal government because the ground is literally melting from under their feet. They frankly lost the lawsuit that they brought. The Ninth Circuit reversed in part because causation was too attenuated and for some other reasons. But, you know, frankly, climate change is the environmental crisis of our time, of generations. And there's no question that just as is the case everywhere else, the people least responsible and least able to respond to it are the ones that will bear the consequences most greatly. And that's certainly true when desertification expands in the Southwest for tribes there and water issues in the Pacific Northwest. The fisheries have already been not decimated. They've been, you know, incredibly damaged, and that'll continue. I'm sort of always telling tribes, first, every resource you've had, local folks have tried to take away from you, so diversify. But secondly, you need to think about food, housing, and energy security. And so tribes really ought to be focusing on at least community-level independence on those fronts. And I don't think I'm alone in recommending that to tribes, but for the most part, federal law has not provided them very good solutions for the problem of climate change. Although we're seeing it with individual issues on the ground, it hasn't been a very effective tool for that colossal problem.
The add-on kind of future issue that I think that one of them that's out there, you know about the natural gas pipeline they're looking at putting across Alaska. You know, it's been out there since the 1970s. The Prudhoe Bay, they have to re-inject some huge quantity of natural gas every time they take out a barrel of oil. And it's a huge cost to the oil companies. So the oil companies have banded together. They've got a $65 billion plan to take the natural gas off the Prudhoe Bay fields, transport it into southern Alaska, liquefy it, and sell it to China. China, by the way, has very little in terms of natural gas resources, so they're an apt customer. There's really a terribly pejorative aspect of that whole project, and that is how the Native Alaskans are being dealt with in that area. I was in Alaska this summer. I was in Anaktuvuk Pass. And when I was in Anaktuvuk Pass, I picked up a piece of paper, and it talked about the study on cultural resources. And on the sheet, it said that the oil companies in the state of Alaska were partnering to study the natives' use of natural resources. And I thought, well, isn't that handy? And then it says community acceptance would be obtained by December of 2014. So I asked this old fellow, his name is Raymond Panic, he's in his 80s. Raymond had lived as a nomadic, part of the nomadic Nunyamits. They're the only inland Eskimos in North America. And I asked him, I said, so did they come, Raymond? Did they come here to get your approval? It says they would have done this last December. And he says, yeah, they came. So, well, tell me about it. He says, well, they came in a big jet airplane and they landed on the runway. And there were about 30 of them, and they were all wearing business suits, and it was a ConocoPhillips airplane, and they brought Kentucky Fried Chicken. And I said, so Raymond, okay, this is weird. Why did they bring Kentucky Fried Chicken? He says, oh, well, that's easy, he says. I mean, this moment is just embedded in my brain. He's eating eggs at his kitchen table, by the way, during this conversation. And he looks at me and he says, well, they always bring Kentucky Fried Chicken when they want us to say yes. And I had the same response. She was like, really? So there are potentially 6 offtake points for natural gas on this pipeline that's to go north-south in Alaska. Whether or not that ultimately ends up being true, what it means for the rural communities there that are largely native, is kind of an unknown. But more than that, it seems to me that that whole process needs a little revision.
Was the Kentucky Fried Chicken successful at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they said yes.
Any more questions? Yes.
My question goes to the DOJ's marijuana memo that they released earlier this year, basically giving tribes the green light to grow marijuana on tribal lands. Now that the dust has settled a little bit more, how are tribes in states that where marijuana is still illegal balancing that?
Well, nothing's changed in southeastern Oklahoma, has it?
So first, the DOJ memo doesn't have the widespread impact that folks think, because given the way that criminal jurisdiction works, for the most part, Indians in Indian country are subject to tribal criminal jurisdiction and federal criminal jurisdiction, but only for major crimes for the feds. They're not subject to state jurisdiction, but white-on-white crime or non-Indian on non-Indian crime is subject to state jurisdiction, even on Indian lands. And victimless crimes, including drug use, are deemed to be subject to state jurisdiction. So if you're in a state that has illegalized the consumption of cannabis, then even if a non-Indian goes onto tribal lands and consumes that cannabis, they're still subject to state criminal law. So the state couldn't stop the tribe from acting, but they could effectively eliminate the consumer base. So that memo matters only where it's been decriminalized within the state, because now the state substantive law isn't going to have that consequence on the marketplace. As far as I know, the tribes that are in jurisdictions that have legalized are having the same kind of debate that that the rest of us are having about the extent to which cannabis ought to be legalized. There are some tribes that have really pushed for industrial hemp. That's a non-drug issue, but unfortunately, it's been caught up in the drug, in the war on drugs. But I think they're sort of debating it. And as far as I know, a few tribes have said that they're going to start participating. But I think the Santee Sioux in South Dakota are the only tribe in a state where it's not legalized that are talking about creating such a system. And I don't have any idea how they're going to address the criminal problem, because South Dakota hasn't really been falling all over itself to be neighborly to tribal governments there.
We have about five more minutes. Are there any other questions from someone who hasn't asked yet?
Yeah, hi, I'm Melissa Mulvey. I live at the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources in Freelancer based in Montana. And you guys may have talked about this in the last panel. I wasn't here before 10, so if you did, then just hold it up. But I'm curious about, I'm thinking specifically of the example of the Wind River Reservation and the mining discharge that was going on there, and the sort of jurisdictional issues with EPA versus state versus tribe, and because the tribe hadn't adopted the same regulations, and my understanding is that the state regulations were actually stricter than the federal regulations, is the onus then on the tribe to adopt those higher standards in order to regulate mine discharge on their reservation property? And I'm wondering if there's a downstream impact off of the reservation, if that's going to trigger them needing to implement these.
You're talking about when standards are lower on tribal land.
Right, but they were the ones that were saying, we need to clean this up, and the EPA was saying, well, you haven't adopted these standards. So I'm wondering who the onus is on in that situation.
I think the rule works both ways. So that if the tribe is causing pollution on state lands, the state can force it.
It was outside operators on reservation land discharging, but it wasn't the tribe.
Well, it's going to be either under tribal authority or under federal authority on tribal land. So it's going to be six of one, half dozen of the other, and the downstream state that's impacted is going to be set in the same shoes as, for instance, the state of New Mexico was when it had to increase its emission standards for its pollution into the Rio Grande River. I think the rule works equally, and I think that's a great question, because it emphasizes this point that you wanted to make, is what's a good story that talks about how there's really equilibrium in the room on this thing, right? And so I think your question emphasizes the fact that, look, no, the rules apply the same way to everybody. And the tribe isn't going to be able to, you know, pull a fast one here and run off with all the chickens. They have to live by the same rules. And I think a story like that, where the tribe is having to live by the rules so that they don't impact a state, is an equally good story to the concept of tribal, state, and local partnerships.
So to answer your question sort of specifically on the reservation, if the tribe had treatment as a state status, it could enforce its own air quality standards, but it would have to implement those standards in the same way that you would another tribal statute or administrative rule. So the onus would be on the tribe to increase its air quality standards if it wanted to enforce more stringent air quality standards. And then, as Jason said, if the tribe is allowing activity within its resources to have transboundary effects, then it's subject to the same upwind limitations that a state would be. But in terms of air quality, the tribe would have to implement stricter standards in order to enforce those standards.
We have time for one more quick question. Okay, do you have 30 seconds each to wrap up?
Actually, just to add one thing, you know, we talked about that fear of tribal government. Because tribes are unaccountable, because non-Indians don't vote in their elections. But I think the Midnight Rider shows just how easy it is to influence tribal governments, because you can go to Congress, which does have authority over tribal governments. And so, you know, all it took was one senator inserting this language in a highway appropriations bill, and it significantly limited tribal jurisdiction. So I think the fear is misplaced, because tribes tend to use their authority in ways that are rational and coherent, and I think it's misplaced because tribes aren't the omnipotent entities that they're described as being in the event that they exert jurisdiction.
I just want to say thanks for the opportunity to be here and speak with you, and I'm really jealous of all you folks from the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you all for coming.